Numbers 19:1 through 20:13, and Exodus 17:1 through 17:7, the eighth talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on December 12, 2004 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Chapter 19 gives the purification rite that the Israelites are supposed to use when someone comes in contact with a corpse. Now, this is following after another chapter in which information is given about the role of the priests and the Levites and how they will be provided for from the sacrifices and from the tithes. So we've got a little bit of legislative material in here. And this is all coming, we don't know exactly where, but it's all in the context of the 40 years that the Israelites are spending in the wilderness after they refused to go into the promised land when God had told them to go. And so God said, go back into the wilderness and you will spend 40 years there until this whole generation dies out. And so this legislation is being given in that context. Now, why this piece of legislation would be here is not crystal clear, but presumably this is being presented because just two chapters previously, God had come in judgment on the Israelites and sent a plague, and as a result of the plague, 14,700 people died. So there are a lot of dead bodies around. And so apparently it's in that context then that this law is being given. There was provision in Exodus. There were statutes in Exodus and Leviticus that say that that if an Israelite touches a corpse, then he has to be purified. But not all of the steps have been given as to how that purification is supposed to take place. And this chapter spells that out. I'm not going to read it. I'll just tell you, I'll just, as best I can, describe to you the rite, the ritual that is to be used for this purpose. They are supposed to take a red heifer, so a young female cow, and that cow is supposed to be taken outside the camp, and the cow is supposed to be killed outside the camp, not by a priest, but with a priest observing. The cow is killed, and I assume by slashing its throat, it doesn't really say. But then blood from the cow is to be taken by using the fingers. The priest is supposed to dip his fingers in the blood and sprinkle it towards the tent of meeting 7 times. Then the cow, together with all of its blood, and it points out that the blood is to be included in this, but all of the other parts of the cow, everything, is then to be burned in its entirety. And while it's being burned, the priest is supposed to add to the fire cedar, hyssop, and scarlet material. All that is put into the fire. Then that is all, when that is all burned up, then another person, so this is a third person that's involved in this, a third person gathers up all of the ashes and takes those ashes and puts them in a clean place that's there outside the camp. And those ashes then are to be mixed with water, and it's that mixture of water and ashes that becomes the purifying agent to use in the purification rites. The heifer that's supposed to be used, it's unusual for it to be a red heifer, and apparently the emphasis in this purification ritual is on the blood. All of the blood It goes out of its way to point out that the blood needs to be burned, and the heifer being red apparently is associated with that as well. And as is typical, this heifer needs to be perfect, without blemish, and one that has not been used for secular use. That is, it has not had a yoke on its neck. So it's set aside for this purpose. When the ritual is done, the priest is then ritually unclean. The one who killed the heifer is ritually unclean. And the one who gathers up the ashes is ritually unclean. They are to wash all of their clothes. They are to wash themselves. And they are to remain outside of the camp until evening. And only then are they considered to be clean and can return back to the camp. Now, these ashes and water are to be used whenever anyone comes in contact with a corpse. If someone touches a corpse, then on the third day, they are unclean. On the third day after they have touched the corpse, then they are to be ritually washed with this purified water and ashes. And then again on the seventh day, they are again to be washed by this mixture. And then they are clean after that second washing. If anyone dies in a tent, then the tent is unclean, and anyone who is in the tent is unclean and needs to be purified, as well as any utensils that are open. Those are unclean as well. If it's a closed container, then that's not unclean. All of those things have to be purified using the same process. And it is pointed out that this is a perpetual ordinance for the Israelites, as well as any foreign aliens among them, that they must follow it. If they do not follow it, then they are to be cut off from the nation of Israel. All right. Chapter 20, then, just the first verse. Then the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there and was buried there. Miriam is the sister of Moses. Miriam, Moses, and Aaron have been providing the leadership of the people of Israel throughout this trek across the desert. And what we're going to see in this chapter is all of the old leadership is going to be dying before the Israelites enter into the promised land. They will not be the ones who will lead Israel into the promised land. And Miriam is the first of those to die. She's dying here just as they apparently are beginning to move to the place from which they will enter into the promised land. It says that this was in the first month. Unfortunately, it doesn't tell us the first month of what. Usually it will say the first month and it'll give you the year. That is not designated here. But as we go along in the text, we find that we are in the 40th year. So presumably this is the first month of the 40th year of their wanderings in the desert. So we're really close to the time in which they will actually enter into Canaan. They are at Kadesh, which is the place where they were camped when God told them 40 years earlier to go in and take the promised land, and they refused to do so. Apparently, for the 40 years, they've been camping at just a handful of places, and presumably staying at some of those places for extended periods of time. But one of the places that they seem to have spent a lot of time at is Kadesh. So apparently they left Kadesh and then came back to Kadesh, and now just as they are about to enter into the land, that's their staging ground. And that's the place where Miriam is when she dies. Now they are going to, as we progress through Numbers, they are going to start making their way up from Kadesh. They'll go slightly east, and then they'll go up on the east side of the Jordan River in what's called Transjordan. And we'll follow their progress in Numbers as they go up there. And then from a place that's towards the northern part of Israel, then they will enter into the Promised Land going across the Jordan. So they'll be entering in a different route than the first one that God had taken them on. Okay, the next section is the one that gets Moses into trouble. We'll read verses 2 through 13. And there was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron. The people thus contended with Moses and spoke, saying, "If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. Why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? And why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us into this place, this wretched place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water to drink." Then Moses and Aaron came in from the presence of the assembly to the doorway of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the rod, and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beasts drink." So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And he said to them, "Listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." Those were the waters of Meribah, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them. This incident is very similar to an incident recorded in Exodus chapter 17. And there are some who have argued that it is actually the same incident that has been recorded twice. However, there are a lot of significant similarities between the two passages. The two incidents are very, very similar. But there are some differences in the way that they are told. And given those differences, it seems to me quite clear that they are different incidents, and we are to understand them that way. So what I'd like to do is go through this section, just talk about what is happening here, and then I want to look back at Exodus 17, read through that, and then we'll make some comparisons. And the question here that is, I think, is striking to anyone who reads it is, what did Moses do that would disqualify him from leading the Israelites into the land? And that's what we'll talk about. The incident is as follows. Once again, they are out of water. So the Israelites are thirsty. They come to Moses and Aaron, and they are confrontational once again. And we've seen this many, many times. This has been repeated time and time again. This time they say, "If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord." And what are they talking about when they say that their brothers perished? It could be that they're just talking about all the people that have died in the wilderness over the 40 years and referring to those as their brothers. But it does say perished before the Lord, which would lead one to believe that there's something special about this perishing, that it's not just a normal perishing, but it's a perishing in judgment. That would make sense. just two chapters prior to this, there were over 14,700 that died in a judgment that God had sent upon the Israelites. So they may very well be referring to that, but they're saying, we would have been better off if we had died in that plague than to be here now and to be thirsting to death. Excuse me. Then he says, why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? In other words, blaming Moses that he's brought them out into the desert and they're just going to die here, die of thirst. Why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us to this wretched place? This is a refrain that we have seen throughout. They're constantly comparing their current circumstances with how good it was in Egypt. And they have romanticized how good it was in Egypt. In Egypt, there was abundance. They may have been slaves, but there was abundance. And in their minds, they've elevated that abundance to be really significant. If only they could have that abundance again. However, you get the impression that by this point in time, that they don't really have a vivid picture of what it was like in Egypt. That would make sense. If this is the 40th year, many of those who were adults when they left Egypt are dead. Many of the people to whom that are still with Moses here have never seen Egypt. They were born in the desert. They've grown up in the desert. So now Egypt is just this thing that they've heard about from their parents to a large extent. Some of them would still remember it, but for many of them, this is just something that they either have childhood memories of or they've just heard their parents talk about. They go on to say, it is not a place, this place that we are right now, is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water to drink. What's interesting about that is they're saying it doesn't have the thing, they aren't referring back to the things that they had in Egypt. The things they had in Egypt were fish and cucumbers and melons, and those are the things they talked about earlier when they yearned for the things that were left behind. The items that are listed here are the items that the spies brought out of Canaan. It's figs, vines, and pomegranates. So they're saying, we aren't in Egypt where that our fathers talked about, and we don't have the produce of the land that was promised to us, the land of milk and honey. We are in neither place. We're in the desert, and there's no water. So Moses and Aaron do what they have done a number of times now in Numbers. They fall down on their face before God. And God speaks to them. And God says, first of all, I want you to take the rod and you're to gather together all of the people of Israel and you are going to go to the rock and you are to speak to the rock so that the rock will bring forth water for all of the people as well as the beasts to drink. So Moses goes to the tabernacle. He goes to the Ark of the Covenant, and before the Ark of the Covenant, he takes the rod that's there. And he goes before the people that are assembled in front of the rock, and he says to them, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? So that's what he says. He lifts the rod and he strikes the rock two times and water comes forth and everyone drinks from it. Okay, let's look at Exodus 17. I'll read that and we'll compare the two. Starting with verse 1 in 17. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin according to the command of the Lord and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more, and they will stone me." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people, and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he named the place Massah and Meribah, because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Obviously, the incidents are very similar. Very, very similar. In this incident in Exodus, however, it appears as though Moses is afraid before the mob. And he says, "A little more and they will stone me." So Moses thinks that he is on the verge of being killed by this mob because they are thirsty and demanding water. But other than that, there are other differences that could be pointed out, but it's hard to determine which ones are significant. There are a lot of minute differences in the way that that's told, but which ones are really significant. I'd like to focus on what God told Moses to do. In this instance, God tells Moses to gather together the elders, as opposed to in Numbers, he has him bring Aaron. And he tells him to take his staff, the staff with which he struck the Nile. So that's the staff that he had when they were still in Egypt. And Moses was told to go before Pharaoh and to strike the Nile with his rod. And by doing so, the Nile would turn to blood. So this is that same staff. And with that staff, Moses is actually instructed to strike the rock. And then it says that water will come forth. In Numbers, what Moses has been told to do is to take the rod or take the staff. And then he is supposed to speak to the rock. There is no instruction given that he is supposed to strike the rock. Which staff is it? Is it the same staff that he used to strike the Nile? Well, when Moses goes to get it, it's the staff that's in front of the Ark of the Covenant. It's the Ark. It's the staff that, where is he? Let's see, it says he goes to get it. And he took the rod, so Moses took the rod from before the Lord. So presumably, that's the rod that was in front of the Ark of the Covenant. Now, two chapters back, God had performed a miracle in order to establish Aaron as the sole claimant to be a priest. And he did so by having Moses collect the staff from the heads of all of the tribes of Israel. And he had everybody write their names on them. And he had Aaron give his staff with Aaron's name written on it. Put all of those staffs before the Ark of the Covenant. And the next day, Aaron's rod had sprouted buds, had produced blossoms, and had produced fully mature almonds. So presumably then, when it says take the rod, and then he goes to get it from before the Ark of the Covenant, it's not the rod that it was talking about in Exodus 17, but rather it's Aaron's rod that he's supposed to take. Now, it is true that in the text it says that Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. And some argue that it couldn't be Aaron's rod because it says his rod. But it seems to me that that could easily be accounted for by simply meaning the rod that he had. It's as if it was as if he had been instructed to pick up a rock and he was supposed to throw his rock. It's not necessarily showing possession, ownership, but rather the one that he had in his hand. So I think that we're talking about a different rod here. And in the way that I'm seeing it, that's fairly significant. I realize that it might be that it's the rod that he had used in Egypt, but I don't think that that's the case. The other difference is that what he says here is distinctive. When he says, "Listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" He says nothing similar to that in the Exodus 17 passage. Then Moses strikes it. He doesn't strike it just once, but he strikes it twice. Water comes forth and the congregation drinks. Okay, what are we to make of this? As to why God is asking Moses to respond differently this time, that is, that he is to do different things to bring water out of this rock from what he was told to do in Exodus 17. I'm not sure. This is what I find particularly difficult about these Old Testament narratives. As I have mentioned before, I'm confident that God in history, as recorded in the Old Testament, is painting pictures, and that these pictures are there for our benefit, and that there are things that God is choosing to represent that are meaningful and significant. And God is inviting us to make associations between what he's saying and truths that he is presenting. The difficulty is knowing which associations to make and how far they are to be carried. And that I have not solved. But I think that this comparison between Exodus 17 and Numbers 20 is suggesting that God is acting a little differently here and is setting up a different set of pictures. And that whereas in Exodus 17, Moses was to strike the rock with the staff that was associated with the plagues and judgment. And here in Exodus 20, in Numbers 20, God is asking Moses to speak to the rock, holding a staff that's associated with the priesthood and life coming out of that which is dead. I think that's significant. I'm not sure exactly what is being intended by that. So I don't have anything particularly profound to say along those lines. I do want to talk a little bit now about what happened to Moses. Why is Moses being disqualified from leading the Israelites into the promised land? There is a lot of speculation that can be found in the commentaries as to what is the nature of Moses' wrongdoing here. I have a list of 10 things that people point out as being the reason, the action that he performs that preclude him from entering into the promised land. One is that he struck the rock instead of speaking, as he was commanded to do. Two, he chose the wrong rock, that he hit a rock that was not the one that the people had gathered around. Third, he struck it twice instead of once. Fourth, it was his temper. Fifth, it was his cowardice, because right afterwards he went to the tabernacle. Sixth, his callousness, because he was mourning the death of his sister rather than taking care of the people of Israel. Seventh, he sounded in what he said, it sounded as though he mistrusted God, but he didn't really. Eight, he actually did doubt that God would bring water from the rock, and so he hit it two times. Ninth, because he called the people rebels. And tenth, because he said, "Shall we bring forth water from the rock?" Now, I puzzled over this for quite some time and have reached some resolution, and I'll tell you what I have decided, but obviously you need to work this through yourselves. What God says are the reasons why Moses is not going to lead them into the promised land is because you have not believed me to treat me holy in the sight of the sons of Israel. I don't think that we should try to pinpoint one action that Moses did that was wrong, but rather see all of his actions as being a representative or indicative of what I think is a wrong attitude on Moses' part. And I think ultimately he is being disqualified from leading the Israelites into the promised land because of self-righteousness. Over a period of time, we have seen Moses regularly intervene when they complained about their discomforts in the wilderness. And they would come to Moses with their complaints. And Moses would, and God would say, "I'm going to wipe them all out." And he's done that a couple of times. And Moses each time has, except for one time, Moses each time has intervened on their behalf and said, "No, no, don't wipe them out. Have mercy on them." And I think what must have happened is Moses has done that regularly, and over time is beginning to see himself as being made of different stuff. Moses is beginning to see, he's beginning to see a gap between him and his fellow Israelites, and at the same time narrowing the gap between himself and God, that he's almost godlike, and he's very different from the Israelites. And I think that's the best way to make sense of what he does here. There's a bit of exasperation and self-righteousness behind what he's doing. So he takes the rod and he says, "You rebels." Well, they are rebels. That's absolutely true. But it's the spirit behind it, I think, that is wrong. But there's a self-righteousness behind it. And he strikes the rock, and he strikes it twice, and I think there's kind of an exasperation, an impatience that's fueled by an attitude, "You schmucks." And then the water comes forth. And he says, "And shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" So he is not recognizing God as holy, because he has narrowed the distance between himself and God. He and God are one and the same. They're on the same side. They're on the same plane. So I think that's what's happened. Moses, in this instance, has manifested a self-righteousness that probably has been growing over time, but now bursts out and is visible at this particular point in time. And I would suspect that Aaron has developed that same attitude. And what we have here is this self-righteousness being manifested in a Howard Dean moment, where he just kind of loses it and gets emotional about it. If that's true, if I'm right, I find that rather intriguing, because that means that the whole generation that had been in the wilderness, it all has to die. Not just those who have been rebellious, and in that sense have not treated God as holy, but also those who have been self-righteous, and in that respect have not treated God as holy. That both are forms of wickedness and disrespect towards God. Both of them are failing to treat God as the holy God that He is. So there are two sides of this coin, both of which are wicked. In any case, I think what we are to understand is this decision on the part of God that Moses will not be the one to lead the Israelites into the promised land is for just cause. That however we understand this, the nature of what Moses has done, he's done something that justifies God's decision. Now, he could have done it with no justification at all. He could have just said, Moses, you're not going to lead them in because I don't want you to. But the narrative doesn't go that way. The narrative attaches it to cause, that there's something that Moses has done that disqualifies him. I think that we need to understand throughout these Old Testament narratives that God is doing lots of different things at the same time. I am confident that throughout these passages, with every individual, God is working with each person individually and bringing about His purposes in their lives. But He's also using each individual in the broader context. They play a role in the lives of other people with whom God is working individually. And God is orchestrating that as well. And furthermore, He is painting a historical drama, the drama of history, the way that He wants it, to present the drama that He wants to present. And that drama unfolds as a result of the actions of individuals. So God is bringing about all kinds of different purposes through the lives of these people as they act in various circumstances. Noah is a fan of J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter books, and he was telling me about an interview that he heard with her, where she was describing writing about the death of Sirius Black. I haven't read these books, but my son has several times. And Sirius, there's this one character, Sirius Black, who dies. And as she was writing this scene where he dies, she broke out into tears. And she was talking to her husband. She was just completely distraught over the death of this character. And he said, well, then don't have him die. And her response was, but the story demands it. And my suspicion is that the same could be said of Moses here. In many respects, Moses is a phenomenal character. He is exemplary. And there is much that is to be emulated in Moses. And in God's history of the world, Moses plays a huge role. But in the drama that God wants to present, Moses has to die before the Israelites go into the promised land. In order to give the drama that he wants to give, Moses has to die. And God has attached it to cause. There is something that Moses has done that justifies precluding him from leading them into Canaan. Okay. 14 through 21. From Kadesh, Moses then sent messengers to the king of Edom. Thus your brother Israel has said, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, that our fathers went down to Egypt, and we stayed in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out from Egypt. Now behold, we are at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We shall not pass through field or through vineyard. We shall not even drink water from a well. We shall go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or left, until we pass through your territory. Edom, however, said to him, you shall not pass through us, lest I come out with the sword against you. Again, the sons of Israel said to him, we shall go up by the highway, and if I and my livestock do drink any of your water, then I will pay its price. Let me only pass through on my feet, nothing else. But he said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory. So Israel turned away from him. So here the Israelites are starting to move up north into the Transjordan area, the area on the east side of the Jordan. And they come to the area that's inhabited by the Edomites. The Edomites are the descendants of Esau, the brother of Jacob, from whom the Israelites are descended. So they send an appeal to the king of the Edomites that he would allow them to pass through their land. And he says, and the Israelites say, we won't mess up any of your fields, we won't mess up your vineyards, we just want to pass through. And the response on the part of the Edomites is, if you come in, we will see that as a provocation to war, and we will take up arms against you. The Israelites respond and they say, if we take anything, we'll pay for it. All we want to do is pass through on the king's highway. That's the route that goes up there. It's not a highway, but it's a well-known path. We are just going to go through on foot, indicating we have peaceful intentions. There are no chariots with us. We aren't heavily armed. But once again, the response is, no, we won't let you do it. So the Israelites respond by going around Edom. They aren't going to challenge the Edomites. And the next section. Now when they set out from Kadesh, the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to Mount Hor. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron at Mount Hor by the border of the land of Edom, saying, Aaron shall be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land which I have given to the sons of Israel, because you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah. Take Aaron and his son Eleazar, and bring them to Mount Hor, and strip Aaron of his garments, and put them on his son Eleazar. So Aaron will be gathered to his people, and will die there. So Moses did just as the Lord had commanded, and they went to Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation. And after Moses had stripped Aaron of his garments and put them on his son Eleazar, Aaron died there on the mountaintop. Then Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain, and when all the congregation saw that Aaron had died, all the house of Israel wept for Aaron 30 days. So here we have the death of the other leader of the Israelites of the old generation. They come to Mount Hor, and Aaron and Moses and Aaron's son, Eleazar, all go up to the mountaintop, and they go up in sight, in the vision of the Israelites. They go up to the mountaintop, and the priestly robes are taken off of Aaron, and they are placed on his son Eleazar, and then Aaron dies. They come back down the mountain, and the whole congregation sees them coming down. Aaron is no longer with them, and Eleazar is wearing the priestly robes. So the baton has been passed, that a new generation of leadership is now taking charge, replacing the old generation. So we have Miriam and Aaron dying in this chapter, and it has been told to Moses that he too will die before the Israelites go into the promised land. So it will be the whole generation then of people that had been involved in coming out of Egypt that will pass away before they enter into the promised land. Okay, questions, comments?
Maybe this is a simple question. What do you make of the fact that God spoke to Moses and Aaron and talked about that they were not going to go to the promised land? I mean, you've focused, and probably rightly so, on Moses, but Aaron got the exact same thing, and Aaron didn't do anything that we know of.
Right. But when God spoke to Moses in this incident in Numbers, Aaron was to go with him. My assumption is that Aaron manifested the same attitudes that we have present in Moses. So I think that they are both being condemned for self-righteousness.
I have a couple questions. The first one would be, could you define holiness? What do you think is specifically in mind here, since God is making that a point? Mm-hmm. Here, you have mm-hmm. not shown my holiness, or...
I think that it is his complete sanctity, his complete righteousness, that he is truly and thoroughly pure and righteous.
So would that translate to Moses with the consequence that he received, that he wasn't trusting God in some way, in the way that he exhibited his anger mm-hmm. or his frustration with the people?
Well,
I'm trying to think what was going on in Moses' mind, because it doesn't say anything about that. The text leaves that out. And I'm wondering what Moses is thinking and seeing with this judgment, so to speak, that God's...
The text leaves what out?
Well, we don't know what Moses thinks.
That's what he's thinking, right? And that's typical of Old Testament narratives.
Yeah.
You aren't told
yeah.
what they're thinking.
Right.
So you have to look at what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... I think what he's doing is the thing that happens often, and that is he ceases to believe in the God that is there.
Mm-hmm.
The God in his mind has become something else, and what God has become is something less than the truly holy and pure thing that he is, such that Moses is seeing himself as pretty much God-like. Well, that can only be if he has reduced God in his purity and holiness in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
So in not trusting God, I think what he's done is he's not trusted the God who is there. He's not believed the God that
it's
is there.
It's pretty amazing when you think about he is there, and
right.
Moses still, I mean, we don't have him here with us in that sense, and that's what we do too. And it's kind of, in a way, encouraging to think here he even has God there and can't do that, and it just says something about our humanness to me.
Right.
It speaks loudly.
Right.
My second question is there anything in their culture that is a regular sort of phenomenon with rocks and water, or is this just something, I know you said you don't have this all put together, because obviously we see in the New Testament Christ is referred to as the solid rock, the foundation. Jesus uses that imagery, the living water imagery, even the whole priesthood thing. I find it interesting in the time that it's the author describes the priesthood robes being taken off and he dies there. It's kind of like the old covenant, the old dying, and Jesus is the priest, Hebrews. And I know you said you haven't tied together all those images, but they just seem to be so, how could this not be coincidental? And in so that's kind of two questions on that. And in their culture, do rocks have water in them? I mean, I'm totally ignorant in that. Or was this like Moses saying, wow, I'm going to go to a rock to get water? Or could you hit rocks and get water? What do you know about that in their culture?
Well, I remember reading an article that was describing a phenomenon in which such a thing could happen, because there are pools of water in holes in rocks in that geographical area. And it is at least possible that one could strike a rock such that it would, if you could punch a hole in that rock, water would come forth. Whether that's what's happening here or not, I don't know. I think you're right in that there is much in this text that's inviting us to make associations. But the thing that I'm having difficulty with is determining which associations are intended for us to make and how far do you take those associations? Because one could run wild with those associations and there has to be some constraint on where you go with all of those associations. So the question is, how do we make sense of these pictures that are being painted in the Old Testament in a way that's disciplined, in a way that helps us to understand what's truly being said? And I don't have the answer to that.
You said that God made Moses not going in with the rest of the people for cause, but he could have easily done it. He could have said, I don't want you to go in just because I don't want you to go in.
Right.
And the question I have is, sometimes it seems like people are saying whatever God wants to do, God gets to do, and nobody can criticize him. And I agree with that, given certain understandings. So I guess what I would say is, if it was okay for God to say, I don't want Moses to go in, and I'm not going to tell you why, I just have my reasons, and I get to have my reasons. If God instead said, I'm going to keep you out for cause, but the cause, he was mistaken or lying. Let's say, I'm going to keep you out for cause, and the cause is that you were self-righteous. But, in fact, Moses was not self-righteous. So, is that okay for God to do that?
No, I wouldn't say it is.
Okay, that's what I would say, too. So, because we have this underlying assumption that God will not lie, he will not do evil, if God were to keep Moses out and not tell us why, there would be some good reason behind it. That's the basis of our... It's not like God is the biggest bully in the universe, therefore he gets to do whatever he wants because we can't fight him. The reason why we understand that what God wants to do, he gets to do, the basis of that is that God is good. Is that...
Right.
Would that be correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Just wanted to...
But God is the one creating the whole picture and all of the pieces of the picture.
Right.
He's going to make it coherent.
Right.
So he's constrained by that. But he has control of all of the pieces such that he can paint the picture he wants to paint.
Right. But underlying all that, it's not just an arbitrary...
Right.
He wants what he wants and he's the biggest bully and he can make it happen, so too bad for us. It's that... He wants what he wants, and he is a good being. Therefore, if we knew what he knew, we'd want, and we were good, we would want that too.
Right.
And so we trust him.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay,